everyone, and welcome back to Science Decoded. It's your favorite first-year grad student, Justin Dingman, out here in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's March 7th, 2021, and that means that it's springtime. Thankfully, the weather's starting to change, things are starting to heat up, and SciWorthy has also gotten a little bit of a facelift in this last year. We've revamped our website so that we can give you guys more effective articles and more interesting articles faster. So a few of the more recent articles that we've posted in the month of March are titled, Do Hand Sanitizers Work on the Coronavirus? And Can Hidden Sulfur Cycling Influence Greenhouse Gas Emissions? So you guys are going to want to go to SciWorthy.com and check that out. We also have a few papers on the docket that are to be published soon. So we're writing summaries on ivermectin used in COVID-19 drug trials. And I'm going to be writing a paper on synthetic cell membranes. So if you're interested in how we synthesize certain parts of the cell and try and make fake cells and where we're at in that process, feel free to swing by our website and click on a few articles. Today's guest will be Dr. Darwin Guevara, and we'll be interviewing him about his paper on using placebo medicine for treating patients with emotional regulation issues. The results will surprise you. Today we're joined by Dr. Darwin Guevara. He is a psychophysiologist at Michigan State University, and we're going to be talking to him today about a little bit on placebos and what his placebo paper was about. So thanks for joining us.
Oh yeah, glad to be here.
So what kind of questions were you asking yourself that led to the development of this placebo project, as well as kind of the development of the experiments that you chose to investigate?
Sure. When I started grad school, I wanted to make emotion regulation easier, right? So I thought emotion regulation was pretty hard for a lot of people, especially for people going through really hard stuff just distressing situations, like maybe a breakup. And so I wanted to make it easier for people. And I thought the best way to do that was to start using principles from the habit literature to make certain emotion regulation strategies easier, right? If you make an emotion regulation strategy a habit, then I think that would make it easier. So I spent months reading about habits and stuff like that. And I encountered this wonderful book by Charles Duhigg on habit principles. And I think it's called The Power of Habit, and I forget when it came out, but it was a great book. And in one of the chapters, in one of my meetings with my advisor, I described an event, I described one of the chapters by where a football coach by the name of Tony Dungy was talking about how he tried to instill habits into his players so that it makes them better football players. Right. So if you could respond a fraction of a second faster than the other player, that makes you a good player. And so he did this, and they got really far in the season. I think they made it to the playoffs, but for some reason, at the end of one of the playoffs, they lost. And so Tony Dungy pointed out to the players that they lost because they stopped believing in these habits. And so I sort of offhandedly mentioned that story to my advisor, and he just really attached himself to the idea, and he's like, oh, you mean believing, like placebo effects, right? And at the time I knew very little about placebo effects, and But I wanted to sort of make my advisor happy, and so I decided to humor him by reading a little bit about it. And then I just sort of fell in love with that literature. And I still want to make emotion regulation easier, but I thought now another way to do that was to maybe outsource emotion regulation to these placebos. And so that's how I sort of got started in conducting research on placebo effects. And I encountered this 2010 paper by Ted Kapchuk and colleagues where they talked about what's called placebos without deception, or open label placebos, or non-deceptive placebos, where you try to harness the beneficial effects of placebos without lying to people. And I just thought it was such a cool way to get these beneficial effects without deception. And it's a long-winded story, but that's how I got into the placebo stuff. And I was trying to figure out why we weren't using this open-label placebo stuff right away. And it turns out there's been – at the time that I did the study, I think there were only maybe, I don't know, 5 to 8 papers that were out. There's a lot more now. But one of the issues that they kept pointing out was – we don't know if this is just response bias, right? We don't know if people are just telling us what they want us to hear. And so I thought that, you know, I would try to help address that issue by conducting this study. And so that's sort of how I got into it, is because, you know, they said that it was an issue, and I think it is an issue. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to help address it.
For sure. So more poignantly aimed at what your paper did, what was your hypothesis going into conducting this research and trying to discover more information about response biases in people?
I obviously believe that it was going to work, right? My prevailing hypothesis was deceptive placebos robustly affect emotions, right? They work across the board. They work in multiple different ways of measuring emotions, so not just only in self-report, but in neurological measures, other physiological measures, you know, including skin conductance response. So I thought emotion was a great domain to study this in, because the deceptive placebo literature sort of strongly suggests that placebos are very effective.
It really goes hand in hand with what you're trying to study, as well as the way in which you want to study it. You know, being able to use emotions as a way to investigate a person's response bias, or how they're believing in certain things that you're telling them, and how that changes what they think about the world or what their perspective is.
Yeah, I thought it was just lucky that I happened to be interested in the domain that placebos are fairly responsive. So I thought that was a happy coincidence.
So can you explain to us a little bit more what you did in this study and how you went about controlling and measuring response bias in your participants?
Right. So response bias broadly is just a term that describes sort of a participant's tendency to respond inaccurately or falsely to questions that's posed to them and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. That's why sort of researchers tend to go at great lengths to hide their hypothesis, right? Because if you know what I want you to answer, and if you like me, you might be more likely to respond the way that I want you to, mm-hmm. right? So we go at great lengths to hide this. Now, unfortunately, non-deceptive placebos, or placebos administered without deception, I can't really hide that from you, because built in the intervention is me telling you, we think this is either going to reduce your emotional distress, or you're going to reduce your pain, or it's going to make you feel better somehow. So you know exactly what I want, right? Which means that the possibility of response bias is exceedingly high, right? So there's no way to get around it methodologically. But there are ways to get around it. Let me backtrack. There are no ways to get around it from that method standpoint, but there are ways around it from a measurement standpoint, mm-hmm. right? Self-report measures are very susceptible to response bias, but there are some measures that tend to be more objective that are less susceptible to it. And one of those measures happen to be EEG measures, or neurological measures of mm-hmm. emotional distress. So we think that this kind of helps gets around response bias because it's a measure that's less susceptible to those type of motivations.
It's kind of more like the hardwire or the fact behind the matter. Like, you can't really hide or frame how the blood and the activity in your brain flows. And by correlating that with previous things, you're able to determine kind of what the true state of the brain is, despite someone trying to hide that.
Right, right. And so that was sort of the logic behind using these more neurological measures. Mm-hmm.
So in your paper I was reading through, and it said you put your participants through a negative picture show task, which was used to kind of correlate or simulate putting them through emotional distress.
Yep.
How did you come to that conclusion, and how can we be sure that just showing people negative pictures actually equates itself to real emotional distress?
Right. So I mean, it's an internal validity question. No, sorry, external validity question. Right. Like, do these things, the emotions that I produce in you with these pictures, equivalent to the emotions that you experience in the real world and stuff? So there's a bunch of standard ways that you can make people feel bad in a lab, right? One of them is actually showing sad movies or movies that elicit either fear or disgust. For example, like one of the movies that people typically use, I think they might have updated this, is that from Lion King when Mufasa dies.
Right? Oh, so that, yeah, that's tragic.
Right, right. So that makes you feel sad, right? So one of the other standard ways that we tend to do this also is we have you think about an unresolved issue in your life, and you just sit there and think about it. That tends to make people sad also. We have you put your hand in cold water. One of my favorite ways that we get people to feel bad or stressed out is we tell you that you're going to be giving a public you're gonna give a speech for about 5 minutes in front of two evaluators, right? And for that hikes up people's stress levels pretty high, right?
A little bit of the public speaking thing coming in.
Right, right. And another way is just pictures, right? Pictures have, it's a visual stimuli that tends to have emotional content, right? Mm-hmm. And the pictures that we show tend to be very, very, it's like high negative, high intensity pictures. Mm-hmm. So it's pictures, I don't know, like people with missing limbs or people in car accidents and stuff like that. So it's highly arousing, distressing pictures, or it's someone who's like on their deathbed or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. These pictures are standardized. They're called the International Affective Picture System. Mm-hmm. And so they've tested this before, and they show pretty standard emotional responses. Like, if we think that if I show you negative pictures, people tend to report highly negative stuff, right? And one of the ways that we can actually get around that too is that we also show neutral pictures, right? So we show you a neutral picture and a negative picture. And for example, I think in the first study, we have a scale from 1 to 9 of how negative you think the pictures are. Mm-hmm. The neutral pictures hover at about like a 1.5. So it's mostly a floor effect. Mm-hmm. And then the negative pictures tend to be around 8.
Okay.
We think that's a pretty good evidence that these are really, really negative pictures and that people see them as such.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. And I had no idea there was kind of an international registry of these pictures out there that kind of are standardized scientifically to elicit these kind of responses, these negative emotions such as sadness or fear.
Yeah, there's an updated one too, I think, that came out in 2017 by a Harvard group too. So it's tons of stimuli.
Well, that's pretty great. You know, it says here in your paper, non-deceptive placebos reduce both a self-report and neural measure of emotional distress. So that was one of the main conclusions that you came to and is stated in your abstract. Can you expand on that conclusion a little bit more?
So we did two studies, right? The first study was sort of a proof of principle study, and we really just wanted to test out the manipulation that we actually had. Our manipulation involved it's an informative manipulation where we educate people about placebos and the placebo effect. And then they get sort of an administration of nasal spray. And so we test that paradigm out. And what we get is that people robustly say, yeah, I feel less bad when I look at these pictures after the administration of a non-aseptic placebo nasal spray. So that's one. The mm-hmm. other finding is the one that's more that more helps address this issue of response bias, right? So it's a very similar paradigm where we get people to feel bad by looking at these pictures, and then we measure their faint electrical signals that are produced by their brain. And turns out some of these faint electrical signals are very meaningful. And one in particular is called the late positive potential, right? Which is electrical activity that tends to happen at central parietal sites. So if you think of the top of your head, like just slightly back and in the middle part, right? That part tends to produce these this late positive potential, and the amplitude of that tends to track with how the negative arousal that you feel when looking at these pictures, right? So there's tons of studies that show that. And what we do is we randomly assigned two groups into where they just watch that stuff and they look at the pictures. They still get a nasal spray, but they just get a different set of instructions. I think we tell them that this nasal spray is intended to get better physiological readings, right? So that was the cover story. And because we wanted to control for the act of getting the nasal spray. And then the other group, they go through an intervention and then look at these pictures. And what we find is the amplitude gets smaller over time for both neutral and negative pictures after the administration of the placebo nasal spray. And to us, this helps address the response bias issue, right? Now we know that it's not just people saying they feel less bad. We see that it actually produces brain changes that are associated with emotional distress. And so I think we're a little more confident that these non-aseptic placebos are leading to or are causing genuine psychobiological effects.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive, because you do have a very strong line of physiologic data to back that up. Where are some other places in the body you might look next to kind of to build some more physiologic evidence that our brain kind of has this level of control or trickery over our body?
Right. So I know there's other studies that have come out recently. I forget the authors, but there was a study, but they use behavioral measures that are fairly consequential. They did a study of people coming out of some sort of surgery. And they gave one group what they called a conditioning open label placebos, mm-hmm. where they paired an open label placebo pill with actual medication, right? So it creates this association, a strong association with it. And they give them the strong expectation that it could possibly work. And then what you get there is actually reductions in reductions in self-reported pain, but I think more consequential is you also get reductions in how much you take active medication,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's a behavioral consequential stuff. But your question is in terms of psychophysiology. I would personally like to see an fMRI study on mm-hmm. non-aseptic placebos and emotional distress, so that we can see brain regions that are associated with emotion regulation, to see sort of how this relates to other emotion regulation strategies that are cognitive based.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably my bet is that's probably what you're going to see in within the next few years. I'd love to be involved in something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what takes place
during one of those studies? So how do they investigate the question a little bit differently, or what kind of methods do they use?
So they probably use very similar paradigms. They probably use a picture viewing paradigm because it lends itself really well to this type of these type of methodologies, mm-hmm. And they just get people to instead of using EEG, they use a magnet or an fMRI machine.
And that stands for femoral MRI, correct?
It's functional magnetic resonance imaging.
Okay. Yes.
Yep. Yep. So I'd be showing you the same type of pictures. I'd give you a nasal spray beforehand, and then I measure bulb activity. And hopefully you probably see less amygdala activity when you're on the placebo, and you might get an increase in prefrontal regions that are generally associated with placebo responses.
For sure. And, you know, reading this paper and hearing about these kind of results got me hopeful for what this kind of might provide patients in the future as far as more physically based injuries or illnesses, as well as, chronic pain. There's a large cross-section between science and chronic pain and mindfulness and trying to figure out better ways to manage that. So how does this study apply to physically based injuries, and where are its limits? Where do you feel like these conclusions start to maybe fall apart?
So I would say there's definitely limits, right? I think what we need to do as a science is map out the domains where it's very effective for, the domains where it's not effective for at all, and then the domains where it might be effective for, but we don't know,
mm-hmm.
right? So sort of mapping out these different domains, right? I think emotional distress, stress-related disorders, affective-related disorders, I think that's I would be willing to bet that that's a domain where it's very effective for. Now, pain-related stuff, probably effective for. So there's a large-scale study that just came out on irritable bowel syndrome and open-label placebo effects. I think it just came out in Pain. I think it came out this week, where they show that you get reductions in irritable bowel syndrome symptoms when you give them an open-label placebo for 6 weeks, right? So they followed people for 6 weeks, and at 6 weeks, you get substantial reductions in irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. Mm-hmm. And they also had an arm that compares that to a deceptive placebo. And for the most part, there's no difference between open-label placebo and deceptive placebo in terms of efficacy.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. So I think it definitely helps for certain conditions. And I think there's a bunch of studies, not a bunch. I think there's maybe two or three studies that looked at it from a lower back pain standpoint. And I think you get substantial reductions in pain also after, I don't remember the length of the study, but I think it's 2 weeks.
Wow, that's pretty quick too, especially for any treatment time.
Yeah, so I think it definitely helps for a certain amount of pain. And I think hopefully we'll see more of this as an alternative treatment or in conjunction with existing types. What you'll probably see more of is it being paired with an active treatment so that the either active treatment becomes more effective, or you need less of the active treatment.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you're probably less of that. So it's being talked about in terms of using less opioids when dealing with chronic types of pain.
Yeah, which lends itself to helping improve the opioid addiction problem that we have here. And there's also a large amount of side effects and comorbidities that come along with frequent and chronic opioid use.
Many
physicians don't talk about when they prescribe for post-surgery or for chronic pain issues.
It's being studied across a wide variety of domains. And so I'm really excited to see for us to map out when it's effective and when it's not and why.
Absolutely. You mentioned in the previous question the phrase deceptive placebo. And I think when our listeners hear this phrase, you guys can kind of equate it to the same thing as what we normally think of in a placebo effect, where your mom just gives you a sugar pill and says, go back outside and play. Do you think we'll ever be able to investigate the effects deceptive placebos have on us? And do you have any personal experience into how that's being done?
Yeah, so actually all of the placebo studies that have been done before this are deceptive studies. Right. Okay. Goes all the way back to I mean, a lot of medical historians and researchers have actually suggested that the history of medicine is just a history of placebo effects, right? you know, that might be such a broad statement.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, placebo effects have been around for a really long time, and it became popular, at least from what I've read, back in the 50s, when a guy by the name of Henry Beecher helped popularize it as a research topic. And so Beecher was a World War II surgeon, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so after he came back from the war, it's a really cool story. So Henry Beecher was a surgeon, and the story goes is that he was a field medic, and one of these field medics, they had such a shortage of morphine in order to conduct surgery. And one day he was about to conduct surgery on a wounded soldier, but there was no morphine. And so he's afraid that if he conducted surgery, the soldier would go into cardiac arrest. And so one of the field nurses, very quick to think on her feet, injected the soldier with saline solution, right? But the soldier believed that it was morphine, and they observed that the soldier immediately calmed down, and he was able to perform the surgery.
Wow.
All right. And so he sort of made this observation. He came back and they started studying this in the US, and he published a seminal paper in Science that talked about placebo effects. And then from then on till now, we've been studying deceptive placebos for a long time. And we study it mostly in medical settings, but we've also studied it in non-clinical samples. Mm-hmm. And we know that it's a very powerful effect. It works across different conditions, and sometimes it doesn't work. And now we're just trying to figure out a way to harness that without lying to people. So,
mm-hmm. You know, just to tell us a little bit more about, you know, your job, what you do, what did a typical day look like when you were taking these measurements of your participants? you know, you had mentioned terms like intervention and control groups and things like that. So, you know, mm-hmm. walk us through what it was actually like to be the scientist behind this.
Right. So when we did this, there's a lot of piloting involved, right? Because you need to be able to craft the manipulation so that we work very hard in making it as convincing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in order for you to do that, there's a lot of things that you have to consider. So, for example, in the studies that was done in 2010 by Kapchuk, they had actual doctors telling participants or patients about placebo effects. Mm-hmm. Right. So these doctors knew what they were doing. You could imagine like high authority. They're wearing lab coats and stuff like that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
In our study, we actually had undergraduate research assistants doing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we were sort of hindered by, impeded by, I didn't have access to medical doctors to give my information, right? So that's why we created a reading manipulation, right, which we borrowed quite a bit from studies on mindsets,
mm-hmm.
by Carol Dweck and Aaliyah Crum, where they try to convince people about different types of mindset and how it could be helpful. And so we borrowed a lot from that. And once we got the manipulation the way that we wanted to, and we think that it's effective, and so we actually ran multiple studies to see if we could convince people that the placebos administered without deception could be effective, then we were confident about running the study. But we wanted to make sure that it was effective, mm-hmm. first, right? As you could probably tell, people have a lot of lay beliefs about placebo effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that we were swimming against the current in trying to convince people that this is a thing that could possibly work. And so once we did that, I had to train my research assistants to deliver the information the way that I wanted to, in a very warm and competent way.
Mm-hmm.
because a perception of the experimenter matters a great deal in inducing placebo effects. If the participant doesn't think that the person is warm, or if the participant thinks that the person is incompetent, then it probably decreases the chances of it working, right? It's kind of like going to your doctor and then your doctor's like dropping his, you know, materials and stuff like that, or doesn't know how to use a stethoscope, or, you know, things of that nature, right? So it's important. So we had to go through this training, and it was a lot of pressure on the research assistants to sort of deliver it the way that I wanted to. And I didn't run any of the participants, I think, in the second study, but I think I ran maybe one or two in a pilot version of this, just to see what it's like. And then after that, it's just a matter of like, it's a data collection. So I made sure that the data was being collected properly, and if there's any hiccups in the nasal spray administration. I think in a pilot version of this, one of the RAs that we were administering this to had a nosebleed, and so we wanted to make sure that none of those adverse events would happen. So it was a lot of piloting, and it was a lot of trying to figure out how to create the best possible situation so that it could produce these effects that we think is there.
For sure. So why do you think this type of research is important to pursue in the long term?
A few reasons, right? So placebo effects work, right? There's this thing that happens in the world that seems to work across different conditions. And it works for depression. It seems to work for anxiety, for different types of pain. And we know that it works. And we just haven't figured out a way to properly harness it. Right. So I typically pick depression, anxiety, and pain because these are conditions that are incredibly debilitating. They tend to be expensive to manage and regulate. And I think placebo effects are one of the big. I think non-acceptable placebos or placebo effects are one of the ways that we can help manage these things, right? And imagine just being able to take placebos instead of antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications. And I'm not advocating that this should be work across the board, right? I'm saying like there are certain types of depression, maybe mild to moderate types of depression that might be responsive to placebos, right? What if we just found a way to use that instead of prescribing people with these antidepressants that might have long-term side effects, you know, or that might have these adverse side effects? Right. If we could figure out a way to use this instead of other treatments that have these, you know, adverse side effects, why not? Right. So I just see it more. I see it more as an alternative to existing interventions that we already have, and something that's probably less expensive, that might not have. These strong side effects that other active medications might have.
Yeah, and I think overall that really increases someone's quality of life and ability to, you know, manage themselves and manage their own emotional health. On top of that, if you're taking placebos or basically sugar pills when typically you would be taking anti-anxiety or antidepressant medications, you could be saving your body a lot of wear and tear in the future, as we know those are tough on the liver, and they do alter your brain and your brain's functionality, and the complete science behind all of those and what's the best way and what's not isn't necessarily known. There's still a lot about the brain we don't know.
And I kind of see it mostly as also as a plus treatment to other things. So there's a wonderful paper that was just published recently by Anne Shenley. I think I'm saying her name correctly. She combined CBT with placebos in treating depression. And I think what they find is compared to a control group, CBT plus placebo is more effective than just CBT alone.
Wow.
So right? I think it opens up the possibility of like really leveraging this thing, this effect for a lot of good. But can I answer this question differently?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So one of the ways that I usually frame this is, so there was a paper that was published in 2010 that came out in JAMA by Fournier and colleagues, and it was a meta-analysis comparing antidepressants and placebo effects in treating depression, right? And what they did is they looked at different people who are experiencing different baseline levels of depression. So you have people who are experiencing mild, moderate, severe, and then very severe depression. Mm-hmm. One of the findings there is that for very mild and moderate depression, there's no difference in terms of efficacy between placebos and antidepressants.
Interesting.
Placebos are just as effective as antidepressants in treating mild to moderate depression. Mm. You actually see the same pattern for severe depression. You only see outperformance of antidepressants for extreme forms of depression. Mm. Yeah, so when I read that paper, I thought, you know, most people suffer from mild, moderate, and low severe depression. Mm. And if placebos are just as effective as antidepressants, then, you know, if we could find a way to harness this without deception, maybe this is a good alternative to treating people instead of giving them antidepressants. So that's sort of what I had in what I thought about when I first read that. But obviously, the answer is more complex than that. So I think what's important here, sorry, I guess the takeaway is, I think this opens up the possibility of using a psychosocial intervention that that's cheaper, that's more cost effective, mm-hmm. That has less severe side effects, and that could be just as effective as other active treatments.
Absolutely, for sure. Yeah. You know, with that being said, is there anything else that you want to say to our audience or our listeners, you know, about this subject or about your research or maybe even why you came on the podcast today?
I think, shoot, this is a tough
yeah,
one.
I always like to ask it.
I came mostly because I want more people to know about placebos without deception. Mm-hmm. Right. I think if I'm fortunate enough to have a lab of my own, one of the goals of the lab would be to help popularize this intervention, the way that mindfulness is incredibly popular in you know, as an intervention for a lot of different conditions, mm-hmm. right? And so I see placebos administered without deception as a sort of an alternative to a lot of different strategies that might be difficult to do on your own. Mindfulness is wonderful, mm-hmm. right? But one of the things that turns people off against it, I think, is that it's kind of hard to do.
Absolutely. To get that much time to sit and to meditate, or some people get really frustrated with it. I've heard a lot like, oh, it's mm-hmm. just not for me.
Right. But you still need something in order to help manage whatever it is that you're experiencing. Now, depression, for example, one of the facets of depression that makes it difficult to treat is that it reduces your motivation to do anything. Mm. Right. And so that's why I think it's important to try to identify strategies that are maybe effective or just as effective or could be effective, but it takes less resources from the person in order to implement mm-hmm. it. And so I think placebos without deception sort of count as one of those, because, you know, it's easy to take a pill.
Absolutely.
And so I guess that's a long-winded answer, is that, you know, I want people to be more aware of this. And I think that you'll start seeing this more, hopefully within the next 10 years, it becomes part of our you know, normal nomenclature, and the people just talk about, yeah, I'm taking open label placebos, or I'm taking non-accepted placebos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's sort of the goal is education at a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing that. There's a group in England that I think just like created a website to educate people about placebo effects, you know. And I think the more people that we could educate about placebos, the more that we can actually the more that we can educate people about placebo effects, it increases the chances of us using it for to benefit people.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your time, Darwin. We really appreciate it.
That's good. Thank you.
And thank you, Science Decoders, for tuning in once again. We'll see you on the next pod, where we'll be talking about climate change and the errors in climate models. So you might want to stay tuned for that one. It looks like it's going to be pretty tempered and hot. Anyways, have a good day, and thank you again so much.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Ilian and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.